Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Thomas Sines, President and General Counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, who assesses President Trump's recent dead-on-arrival proposal to end the government shutdown. Isabel Guerra, of the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths, who talks about her colleagues who were recently convicted on federal charges of leaving food and water for immigrants trying to cross the desert along the Arizona-Mexico border. And Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, who discusses the critical issues at the heart of the Los Angeles teachers' strike and major challenges for public education nationwide. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over a month of street protests calling for the ouster of Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, have taken a toll on the Khartoum regime. Al-Bashir, who rose to power in a 1989 coup, faces earlier charges in the International Criminal Court for alleged genocide in Darfur. In mid-December, a small demonstration led by school students in a town near the border with Ethiopia protested rising bread prices. Security services responded by gunning down 10 protesters, three of them children. Protests soon erupted in cities across the East African country, with calls for Bashir to resign, targeting the offices of his ruling National Congress Party and Sudan's intelligence services. In recent days, a protest outside the Royal Care International Hospital in Khartoum led to the shooting of a medical doctor and a 16-year-old boy by security forces. The extended protests have attracted new middle-class activists to oppose Bashir, who has strong backing from the military and Islamic groups. Still, Bashir can rely on foreign allies, including Saudi Arabia, Egypt, China, and the United States, who seek political stability in the Horn of Africa. The U.S. Supreme Court turned back an attempt by ExxonMobil to halt an investigation by Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey, seeking to expose the oil giant's role in promoting climate change denial. ExxonMobil is now facing a series of lawsuits from other state attorneys general, seeking evidence on how the company's top executives, including former U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, reacted to the looming threat of global warming. When in 2016 Healey sought to obtain decades of internal documents concerning Exxon's response to climate change, company lawyers challenged the state's legal standing to demand the information requested. The American Prospect reports that a lawsuit launched by New York State alleges ExxonMobil engaged in a long-standing fraudulent scheme to deceive investors about the impact of climate change regulations on the company's bottom line. A brief by state lawyers claims Exxon knew its representations were not supported by the facts and were contrary to its internal business practices. State attorneys general are pursuing a legal strategy against the fossil fuel industry, similar to what states successfully used against tobacco companies over 20 years ago, when they sued cigarette manufacturers for deceptive marketing practices. Buffalo, New York, first desegregated its schools in 1976. In response to a federal desegregation order, the upstate city established a new magnet school program. The magnet schools voluntarily drew students from across the city to create racial balance in public schools. Buffalo's magnet school program became a national model in the 1980s, having reduced the city's number of racially segregated schools by more than half. But over time, racial integration progress stalled. By 2012, the Christian Science Monitor reports 70% of Buffalo's public schools were once again segregated. In the 1990s, a series of Supreme Court decisions limited the tools available for school districts to racially integrate. After Buffalo became the target of a civil rights complaint in 2014, Kreiner Cash, appointed as the city's new superintendent in 2015, worked to foster higher expectations and equity in the city's classrooms. Statistics show that African Americans who attended integrated schools in the U.S. in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s had better outcomes than those who did not, and that the benefits persisted among their children and grandchildren. But Gary Orfield, co-director of the Civil Rights Project, says that without the pressure of civil rights requirements, elementary and secondary schools are becoming more unequal. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
The longest government shutdown in U.S. history entered its second month on January 21st. The partial shutdown affecting 9 federal departments and smaller agencies placed more than 380,000 federal workers on furlough and forced another 420,000 employees to work without pay. Without a viable plan in sight to negotiate a settlement of Trump's demand to Congress to allocate $5.7 billion in funding for his border wall, federal employees will have gone 4 weeks without a paycheck. The growing turmoil stemming from the shutdown can be seen most visibly at the nation's airports, where the Transportation Security Administration confirmed that the national rate of unscheduled absences today was 7.5%, compared to a 3.3% rate 1 year ago. Fewer security agents has meant longer lines for hundreds of thousands of airline passengers. In a nationally televised speech on January 20th, President Trump offered 3 years of protection from deportation for DACA recipients and tens of thousands from nations who qualify for temporary protected status, programs the president had previously unilaterally ended with an executive order. The offer was quickly rejected by House Democrats, who dismissed the deal as a compilation of several previously rejected initiatives. Your reporter spoke with Thomas Sines, president and general counsel of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, who assesses Mr. Trump's dead-on-arrival proposal to end the government shutdown.
Well, I think it's deplorable that we have now the longest partial government shutdown in our history. It's entirely the result of Donald Trump's insistence on a huge investment in an unnecessary wall at the southern border, and his refusal to engage in anything that approaches reasonable negotiations. Although he touts himself as a great negotiator, what he put on the table a few days ago is clearly a non-starter. He should have known that from the very beginning. You don't offer 3 years of temporary protection for million-plus folks in exchange for a permanent, extremely costly, and unnecessary border. To the tune of over $5 billion. That's not even close to a reasonable way to start a negotiation. So it appears that Donald Trump will continue to punish federal workers, just as he has targeted throughout his tenure, Latinos, Muslims, all immigrants, women. And he seems to have a perhaps better hidden, but now manifest dislike for federal government workers as well. I don't think there's much other explanation for his inability to understand the extreme suffering that he's imposing on so many families, simply so that he can have a monument to himself in the form of an unnecessary wall.
Democrats have said that they're willing to sit down and discuss any number of these issues, but they insist that the government should be open first, laying the groundwork, the significant groundwork, for substantive talks. Is that something that you feel is a valid position at this point?
I think it's clearly true that these are long-term issues. The issue of protecting the Dreamers has been around for decades, a recognition widely shared that those who came here as minors were raised here, were educated here, and are ready, and indeed already are making a contribution to our economy, ought to be protected permanently. TPS, temporary protected status has, for many of the countries involved, been in effect for over a decade and a half. So these are long-term problems. It certainly makes sense that we negotiate those long-term problems, not with a looming and continuing shutdown, but in the course of ordinary lawmaking at the federal level.
One concern I've heard expressed by Democrats and people opposed to the Trump-imposed shutdown is that if they were to give in to the demands of Donald Trump for funds to build or partially build his wall, that there would be no end to what they term hostage taking in the future, that Trump would see, hey, this is a gimmick that works, we'll shut down the government, that would assist him in pressuring members of the opposite party from giving him what he wants.
I think it's a legitimate concern in the way he deals with foreign governments and the way he deals with so many others. This administration has shown a tendency toward brinksmanship, and that's really not a good way of resolving any deep-seated problem that requires wise consideration. So I am saying I share that concern about really incentivizing other forms of brinksmanship at the level of serious policymaking that's involved here.
Well, just a final question on this. What are the essential elements, in your view, of comprehensive immigration reform that this country needs?
Well, I think it does start with ensuring that we protect the over a million workers who have been contributing to our economy, and that's both DACA recipients and TPS holders, and that we protect them long term. We have to address the rest of the undocumented population, the vast majority of whom came here peacefully and contribute to our economy and our society and raise families, including U.S. citizen children. We also have to address the constitutional flaws in our existing immigration system that exist solely because immigration is an exception to so many of the laws that we all ascribe to. There is, in our current allocation scheme for lawful permanent residents, blatant facial discrimination on the basis of national origin. There are daily due process violations in our immigration courts, and now attention has been brought to those kinds of due process violations at the border. So we have to really ensure that our immigration system on a go-forward basis better reflects the constitutional values that we all ascribe to. And that begins by protecting those who are here and adopting a system for the future that has the hallmarks of fairness and due process that are so central to our constitutional scheme.
That was Thomas Saenz, President and General Counsel of the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Find more commentary and analysis on opposition to Trump's demand for border wall funding and the government shutdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On January 18th, four volunteers with a humanitarian aid group, No More Deaths, No Más Muertes, were convicted for several federal misdemeanor charges for leaving water, packaged snacks, cans of beans, and socks in the desert for immigrants trying to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. The group operates in the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, which encompasses more than 800,000 acres along the Arizona-Sonora border. The refuge is part of the Ajo Corridor, which extends from the border to the town of Ajo, Arizona, a desert region that has been most deadly for immigrants trying to cross into the U.S. undetected. Unlike the thousands of families who've arrived at the border in the past few years, who turn themselves in to Border Patrol agents in hopes of claiming asylum. The No More Deaths volunteers were arrested in the summer of 2017, shortly after posting a video of a Fish and Wildlife official emptying several rescue gallon containers of water onto the ground. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Isabel Guerra, a volunteer with No More Deaths. Here she describes the work her group does, the unforgiving desert terrain where they provide humanitarian aid, and what's next for the volunteers, who are facing a sentence of 6 months in jail.
We'll go with a group of volunteers, Spanish speakers, folks with medical experience, and folks with experience with navigation and working out in that area, like having done volunteer work before, just familiarity with the landscape. and we'll go out, we'll hike anywhere, depending on what trails we're working with. It'll be, you know, half a mile to a mile, up to stretches of 7-8 mile hikes, carrying heavy loads of water. Most people will carry about 4 gallons of water, 4 to 6 gallons of water in their backpacks. 1 gallon of water is about 8 pounds. Yeah, we're hiking out there with quite a bit of weight in the desert sun. Essentially, what crossers are hoping to find is just to go around the checkpoint station. So not only is there a border wall currently up in the major ports of entry, there's a ton of surveillance in the area and like the more proximate area to the ports of entry. But then there are checkpoints up the major highways. So folks are forced to walk around in the remote regions to get past the checkpoints where Border Patrol has stationed up on the highways. That's 50 plus miles to 100 miles off of the borderline, off the line with that border with Mexico.
So Isabel Guerra, you said 9 volunteers with no more deaths have been arrested and 4 went to trial last week. Please tell us what happened.
They have federal misdemeanors, being littering, abandonment of property on the wildlife refuge, the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, and trespassing on unauthorized roads. Their original dates of their offenses goes back to the summer of 2017, so it hasn't really been a recent incident. There had been a long struggle with the Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Agency, Fish and Wildlife, who governs the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge, to allow humanitarian aid to be done in the refuge. For many months, there had been like a back and forth, meeting with the supervisors at the refuge, meeting with, you know, officers, just going back and forth, having discussion about what could be done. With the Fish and Wildlife, they had said no to the humanitarian aid because the Border Patrol has beacons out in the desert, and they claim that those beacons provide enough aid for migrants walking and that there's no need for additional resources out there in the desert to prevent death.
How do the beacons work?
So the beacons are several dozen feet high. They emit a blue glowing light for, I believe, a radius of under 10 miles. And so the idea behind that is that folks can see this flashing light, are attracted to it, and then press a button for a rescue response with Border Patrol. And at that point, if you've pressed the button, the expectation is that Border Patrol will come out to your location, be able to find you and provide you with a rescue, and then you move forward in that process of deportation. However, a lot of our data of folks, just the number of times the button is pressed and the lack of response from the Border Patrol is significant. If those beacons themselves don't work, their response is really, really minimal. And then any kind of search and rescue projects that they're doing is super minimal compared to the numbers that we've been able to collect with our data of folks passing through these areas, remains that are found out in the desert. Their projects alone are not enough to address the issue of people dying out in the desert.
How many border crossers have died in recent years?
So in the year 2017, that summer of when the volunteers were arrested, there were 128 known migrant deaths in Arizona. 58 were found in the area around the Cabeza Prieta Wildlife Refuge and in the Ajo Corridor. That accounts for 45% of all the human remains recovered in Arizona. So that is a really dramatic percentage of folks across the entire border are concentrated in that area. That's why our work in the Ajo Corridor specifically is super significant, because that's where the highest concentration of deaths are happening. It's a death sentence to be forced to walk through the desert. And what our organization, what we're doing, what we believe in is that no one should have to die. No one should be forced to die this way.
So those convicted on January 18th are facing 6 months in jail. Are they appealing?
So it's still a conversation with the defendants and with our organization. The plan, I believe, is to appeal and continue fighting this. However, we want to invite everyone into the discussion of how, with this case, saying that it's a criminal offense to provide food and water and aid to another human being. What does that mean for the rest of us? What are we going to be doing? as we see, you know, our country moving in this direction, finding these kinds of humanitarian acts to be criminal.
That was Isabel Guerra with the group No More Deaths, a ministry of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tucson, Arizona. Learn more about the group's humanitarian aid work along the U.S. southern border by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In another sign of growing anger and militancy among U.S. educators, teachers in Los Angeles walked off their jobs for the first time in 30 years on January 14th, effectively shutting down the second largest school district in the U.S. The strike, supported by an overwhelming majority of the city's 30,000 teachers, was called to demand increased wages, smaller classroom sizes, the hiring of more support staff, including nurses, counselors, and librarians. After walking the picket line for 6 school days, LA's teachers won a tentative deal that included a 6% pay raise and caps on class sizes, the hiring of full-time nurses for every school, as well as a pledge to hire librarians for every middle and high school in the district by the fall of 2020. In the deal announced January 22nd that was quickly ratified by union members, the city and county also committed to expand programs to provide additional support services for the district's neediest students. The LA teacher strike echoed complaints about the failings of U.S. education, heard in statewide strikes and job actions in 2018 in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Colorado, and Arizona. Your reporter spoke with Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, who assesses the damage austerity budgets have done to public schools and the threat charter school privatization poses to public education.
The teacher strike in LA is part of a larger movement by teachers to stand up and defend public education. So this has been going on for a while. There are a couple of main models of teachers unions out there. One is the service-oriented union, where the idea is that the union will negotiate contracts and defend teachers on an individual basis. And it's basically the union provides service to the members. But another model, the social organizing model of teachers unions, looks at the teachers themselves as being the union. So it's the union is not the separate entity that does things for us. We are the union. And this model looks at broader issues. It's not just what's going on in the classroom. It's not just wages and working conditions, but how does what is happening in schools and what is happening in our district connect to larger issues of social justice and the role of education in a democratic society. And so, looking at that big picture, there are really frightening moves toward privatization. We have a Secretary of Education who is pretty unabashedly pro-privatization, the inroads of charter schools and charter management organizations leaves teachers with a lot of work to do. So I was really excited when Alex Caputo-Pearl and the progressive caucus that he's a part of came into power in LA. And I thought this might happen, that the LA teachers might join the rest of the movements in the country around defending public education.
As you discussed in your article, there have been statewide teacher strikes in 2018 in West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Colorado, and Arizona. Tell us about the environment in terms of austerity that teachers and students have experienced with a lot less resources flowing from state governments to schools across the country.
There has been a marked disinvestment in public education, both at the K-12 level and in higher education also. And Interestingly, many of those wildcat strikes were in very red states, right? Some in right-to-work states where the ability of teachers' unions to collectively bargain was limited, but teachers still stood in solidarity and took tremendous risks to their jobs and perhaps to their reputations and the opinions of their neighbors, right, to defend public education. So that was very exciting to see how many teachers, even in a very conservative political climate, were willing to stand up. In Chicago and in LA, it's a little bit different. Chicago and LA are both pretty blue, pretty democratic, but the forces of privatization are still strong. It's been a really bipartisan effort to weaken public schools. What was passed under the Race to the Top legislation has been so destructive in terms of value added in teacher evaluation, which means that teachers' evaluations are heavily dependent on students' test scores, which those are more impacted by parental income than anything else. So it just punishes the teachers who choose to work with the highest need populations, as well as being statistically indefensible. It's been both a Democratic and Republican project to dismantle public education. And so it's exciting to me to see teachers in both more progressive and conservative areas standing in solidarity together.
That was Isabel Nunez, professor of educational studies and director of the School of Education at Purdue University. She's co-author of the book titled Worth Striking For: Why Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concern, Lessons from Chicago. Learn more about the battle to preserve and advance public education by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, KMEC in Ukiah, California, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.